guys word. We no care what them a say. We no care what them a say. Put your bless no man curse. We no care what them a say. We no care what them a say.
Welcome to Upstage on July 1st, 2021. I'm your host, Sarah Day. For tonight, playing you the version of the show from July 2nd, 2020, a retro look back for you. Thank you so much for tuning into Upstage. Good evening. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio. From drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between, I'm your host, Sarah Day, recording from home on July 2nd, 2020. Happy belated Saint Jean Baptiste and Canada Day. Hope you're staying cool and enjoying your summer. On tonight's show.
The key element of it was at my mum's funeral, I had lots of people come up to me. This is what happens at funerals, you know, people come to you and tell you that your loved one was wonderful. Literally all of them, I just thought, who are you? And you don't know, you didn't know my mum. And that's just what you say. And what it does is it erases someone out of existence if you say that, because you say it about everybody. Everyone, if everyone's wonderful, no one is anything. So I felt kind of angry about it.
You absolutely have things in this show that you wouldn't think to find in a traditional comedy show. Either we are touching on some darker subject matter. We're talking about reproductive rights. We're talking about the disbelief of assault victims. We're also talking about super relatable, recognizable things, like the fact that we will all eventually turn into our parents one day. We cannot stop that.
Yeah, I was like, just say one nice thing about me. They're like, yeah, it's no problem. And I do. Russell Peters was the best. He was like, can you just... Oh, no, it wasn't for that. It was for my Netflix special. He goes, can you just tell me exactly what to type to tweet, and I'll just tweet that.
In Montreal, July means just for laughs. Although it's now got offshoots in Toronto, Vancouver, Australia, and even South Africa, the home of the world's largest comedy festival is right here in Montreal. This season's festival has been postponed to the fall due to COVID-19. I wanted to look back at some of my favorite conversations from Just for Laughs past. So tonight, a curated set of conversations from the past couple of years. You will hear British comic David Baddiel on the very personal one-man show he put on back in 2017, American comedian Ari Shaffir, and Carly Heffernan, who brought a feminist sketch show to town last summer. But first off, David Baddiel. The British performer started out in stand-up after university, Cambridge, but has since branched out very widely since then. He has written novels for adults, books for kids, performed as a stand-up, written comedy for radio, and he also wrote and starred in a sitcom called Baddiel's Syndrome with his wife Morwenna, who's a performer, acting alongside him. David's made documentaries, has been on chat shows discussing wisdom, prejudices, different forms of expertise. But the one-man show he brought to Montreal was personal. We meet his mother, who escaped Nazi Germany to England as a baby, and his father, now suffering from dementia. The show covered social media, anti-Semitism, and his recently deceased mom's obsession with golf. It was personal and deeply funny. My Family, not the sitcom, first premiered in London in spring 2016. It toured for weeks and was performed at La Chapelle Theatre at Just for Laughs in 2017. Here is my conversation with David Baddiel.
David, thank you so much for joining me.
That's okay. Very nice to be here.
The idea of telling a person's whole story, the blemishes, the peccadilloes, but also the good things, when did this idea of being able to tell your parents as whole individuals, when did it come to you?
The key element of it was at my mum's funeral, I had lots of people come up to me. This is what happens at funerals, you know, people come to you and tell you that your loved one was wonderful. And literally all of them, I just thought, who are you? And you didn't know my mum. And that's just what you say. And what it does is it erases someone out of existence if you say that, because you say it about everybody. Everyone, if everyone's wonderful, no one is anything. So I wanted to, I felt kind of angry about it at some level. And what it led me to was a desire to tell my mum's story primarily, but it included, as time went on, my dad's story to some extent, because he's got dementia, quite advanced now, and his type of dementia is also something that people will start saying, oh, you know, normally about someone with dementia, oh, they were so sweet and lovely or whatever. And my dad was never that. And also, he also has a type of dementia which makes him very extremely rude and abusive, and he was always like that anyway. So it's sometimes hard to know whether or not he's actually got dementia or whether he's just being himself in a bigger way. So those two things felt to me like joined in a way in a quest for the truth about what people are actually like. And in some level, if you tell the truth about what your parents are like, you're telling the truth about who you are. And so that was what I wanted to do. And the comedy is what makes it a thing, because my show, if it wasn't funny, it just like would just be quite grim, I think, because it does involve infidelity and psychotically bad parenting and dementia and whatever. But if you find the funny in it, it becomes a celebration. You know, and that was really my thing. It's like, okay, I'm going to tell the absolute truth about my parents with a warts and all thing, but it's going to be funny, and the honesty in itself will make it funny, and it will also be, for want of a better word, healing, because it's a really appalling thing when your parents die or get dementia. You know, it's very extreme to the psyche, and I think if you can find the comedy in it, then that's a way of getting through it.
Did anyone ever turn to you and say, this is too personal, you can't talk about this stuff on stage, you can't talk about it to the media?
Yeah, or quite a lot. Certainly when I was getting the show together, and both my brothers were really worried about it. I have two brothers, they were really worried about it, especially my younger brother, who was a cab driver in New York, and he just emailed me. I was in China at the time filming something, and he just emailed me and heard about it and said, you're not doing this. And I said, Dan, that's his name, you've got to, like, just see the show. It's hard to describe. I know it sounds bad that she's died, like, 3 months ago, and now I want to talk about her having sex with a golfing memorabilia salesman. But trust me, it's going to be a feel-good show. And that's true, and he loves the show, and turns to my older brother now. It's the tone of the show is, you know, it turns into a celebration through using there's an expression in Britain, I don't know if you have it here, but you shouldn't wash your dirty linen in public or your dirty laundry in public, right? What my show is a huge public washing of my family's dirtiest laundry in a very, very positive way. In like, here it is, the dirtiest laundry, and by not being ashamed of it, it kind of turns it into something positive.
But I hadn't realized that 3 months had passed between her passing or her funeral,
yeah,
and
that's
you
when
just
I started doing it. My older brother, who I listen to a lot and probably closest to, did say to me, can't you leave it for a bit? And I said, no, I can't, because it's in me and I want to talk about it. And when that happens to you as a comedian or a performer, it's almost unstoppable, I think.
I was going to say, if like 5 years had passed, would your cab driver brother be like okay with it?
Yeah, well, he's okay with it now, but he might have been okay with it if I presented it to him with 5 years, maybe, yeah. But actually the rawness of it had something to do, I think, with it. Because as I say, I'm fixing something here, I think, as well. I mean, towards the end of the show, I talk about whether or not my mum would be okay with me doing the show, and I find a place where I'm absolutely certain she would be. But I also talk about something else. I say, not only do I think she would be okay, I think there is something comically life-enhancing about talking about her like this. And I'm not going to tell you what happens, but there's a bit that I explain that happened just after she died that was absolutely hilarious, to do with the affair that she had, and it was to do with my younger brother being really angry about something, but it transformed into something hilarious. And I think in that moment you see a kind of metamorphosis of sadness and anger and loss into something okay. Not okay, it's not okay that anyone, you know, dies that you love, but that makes the narrative have an ending that's different.
You have kids, and having looked and examined your parents' life so carefully, has it made you, you know, reconsider how you've acted around your kids, or made you think about, what are they going to say when I get sick or when I kick the bucket?
I'm certainly not worried about what my kids might say about me. I actually think it's almost the other flip thing, because I think I am a modern parent. My parents were the opposite. My parents never stopped their lives for me. They were 70s people, so it didn't occur to them. You know, I saw someone yesterday, Jerry Seinfeld, talk about how when he grew up, his parents didn't even know what his name was, right? And that's kind of true about parents in that generation. The whole idea that we have to spend every second monitoring our children so they're not in any way... That's a modern idea. And I am basically that guy. And as a result, I think, although my kids actually are both funny, in the longer show I do in London, I talk about this, about how I worry that if we overcare for our kids, they won't be funny, because I think there's a certain link between being damaged and being funny. But they both are funny, and if they want to do a kind of roast of me when I die, I am very happy with that, because I'd much rather that than they said something idealised. My daughter has now come and seen the show. She's 15, and she absolutely loved it. And my wife was really worried about it, because she was worried about it thinking, like, but this is her grandma, and you're talking about this extreme behaviour. And I said, yeah, but she should know who she really was. I'd rather that. And she did love it. You know, and actually, I often find myself towards the end of the show a bit on the edge of tears. And when Dolly was there, I did cry when she was there at the idea of, you know, doing that, presenting this version of, not in a bad way. Like, I was really pleased that she was there and was able to see this, you know, other version of my mum.
How do you write? Like, what's your habit? Do you, like, sit down at a desk for 3 hours? Do you have to write out of the house?
I am incredibly rubbish and undisciplined at writing, but I do it all the time. So that's how I get by my undiscipline. So I sit down at my computer virtually every day. I spend ages fucking about, not writing, looking at the internet. The internet is a massively problematic thing for writers. Making cups of tea, making phone calls, eat whatever, and then eventually I will start writing. As I say, I combat my failure to write by taking my laptop with me virtually everywhere. And so I'll write, like, on public transport, I'll write of football matches, I'll write sort of everywhere. And that gets by. But at the moment, I am not writing enough. I mean, I do write a lot. I've written 4 adult novels, 5 children novels, you know, a movie that's going to blow. I mean, and all this stand-up, whatever. And I think I could have written about 4 times as much if I actually was disciplined. When I was writing novels, I mean adult, grown-up novels, I used to try and set myself a word limit of 1,000 words a day. And that I sort of managed to do that, but that seems to have gone as I've got older and even less disciplined.
Do you keep your laptop with you to write, you know, when you say on public transit, like anywhere? Is that because you just, like, want to be there when the moment seizes you? You want to be able to put something down?
No, it's not quite as airy-fairy as that. It's more like, okay, I've spent 3 hours in front of my computer. I've only written 5 lines. That's rubbish. I'm going to a meeting. I won't get a taxi because I can't write in a car. I will deliberately get the tube to the meeting so that I can write for 30 minutes. And actually, you know what? I'll probably write more on the tube because I'm less distracted because there's no internet. And actually, in London, one of the things you may know about travelling on public transport is no one really wants to talk to each other. So having a laptop is a good way of not talking to each other. And I get recognised a bit, but then I just keep my head down. So, yeah, it's a shield as well as a tool for writing on.
And nobody wants to steal your laptop on the tube, I assume, as well.
No one has so far stolen it, although occasionally people have asked me, who've recognised me, what I'm writing. And actually, really sweetly, very recently, a woman came up to me with her kids and said, my kids have recognised you, and are you? They want to know if you're writing your new children's book. And I said, yes, I was, and I showed them a little bit of it, and that was really sweet.
That's quite special.
Yeah, it was. It was really nice, really nice. They were very excited. So I was quite excited.
You've got fans of all ages.
Yeah, well, I've got this new... The kids' books have done really well, and I've got this whole new audience now who must never come to my stand-up shows because they're really not for children. That's slightly confusing. I've had parents who don't really know my work write to me and say, can I bring my 9-year-old? I've said, absolutely not. But, yeah... I am recognised quite a lot now by children, and their parents in general also know me, because I've been around British culture, popular culture.
You say things, and it gets written up, like in the Daily Mail. Like, you tweeted something about Theresa May, and that was a thing.
Oh, that happens a lot, yeah. Well, that's partly just journalists being lazy. I use Twitter a lot. I like Twitter, even though it's got massive negativity things. So I actually like it. I like it as comedy. I think it's a comedy medium, or certainly a good medium for comedians, because you can write really funny one-liners and people write funny stuff back to you, and this is a way of communicating to an audience, you know what I mean? It feels like it. And in my show, actually, I begin by talking about social media. I begin by talking about the amount of retweets and whatever you get. It's like a virtual laugh for comedians. And also I talk about the outrage and whatever. And yeah, that does happen. But as I said, that's partly journalists who can't be bothered to think of something interesting to say about Theresa May, so they'll just quote me or whoever else.
Is it weird when that happens?
No, I'm really used to it. It happens all the time. Another thing that happened, which is also in my show, I don't want to give away anything, but I was doing an interview in which I talked about my dad's dementia. I talked about my dad's dementia, and the way I talked about it was to say that because my dad has dementia, every time I forget something now, I think, oh, early onset. And then that led to the journalists printing that as if I was announcing that I had dementia, right? And then next thing I knew, every newspaper in Britain had run with this kind of story that I was announcing that I had dementia, and it was incredible. I mean, I had to stop it, because I don't have dementia. I have fears about getting dementia because my dad has dementia, but it's amazing. So that stuff does happen, yeah.
And I'd like to think if you did have dementia, you know, God forbid, you would have done it in a much more big announcement kind of way, or made a show out of it, or done something more dramatic.
I don't do this in this show here, but one of the things I say, yeah, is that one of the articles says, David Baddiel is pretty sure he has dementia. And yeah, that's the way I'd announce it. I might have, I'm not sure. I don't really know anymore because I've got dementia. It's incredible. But I've sort of been a public figure in Britain for a long time, but the previous show I did was partly about that. It was mainly about how it's really weird. I'd never seen anyone do this. What my last show was about the mundane reality of being someone who's a bit well-known, and therefore, so you get into stuff like that. Like, I did a whole bit about, I'm a Peter Gabriel fan, and I was at a Peter Gabriel gig, and then I read that I'd caused trouble at this gig and got really drunk and had a fight. And I contacted The Times, the newspaper it was in, like a proper newspaper, and I said, this wasn't me. And they were like, yeah, it was, and we've got witnesses or whatever. And I keep on telling it wasn't me. And eventually I got in touch with Peter Gabriel, and he knew who it was, right? And as it happens, it was a bloke. I did a single in 1996 with this band about football, and it was the guy in this band who looks like me but is also associated with me, so that's why The Times or someone made that mistake. So this is like ridiculous, completely ridiculous story, but in the end it was good because it was part of my show. But you see what I'm saying is, the show was not, hey, it's great being famous. The show was, being famous is like this, it's full of nonsense. And actually his name is Ian Brody, I called him up and he said, oh yeah, that did happen. I got drunk and I got, and then he said, "Don't tell anyone." I thought, like, too late. It's in the show. It's in the show.
I have to clear my name.
Yeah, exactly. I have to clear my name, but also it's in the show. The Times did apologise as well.
As they should.
Yeah, but it was a kind of wanky apology, which they were sort of like still taking the piss. Anyway, all of this is in my previous show, but I might do it again.
Well, thank you so much. I hope we get to see it. If you do it again, bring it back to Just for Laughs.
I might do. It's been really great. It's been really nice being here. Really nice talking to you.
Thank you.
That was comic and writer David Baddiel. Visit him at davidbaddiel.com. I'm Sarah DeA. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. We're revisiting past interviews of some of the talent that pops into town for Just for Laughs. Still to come, my conversation with provocateur comedian Ari Shafir. But first, Carly Heffernan is a director and writer of She the People, a sketch troupe at Toronto's Second City. Created, written, and performed all by women, the show has a provocative and feminist message. I'll take this copy from Second City. This mimosa and madness-fueled foray roasts the patriarchy, taking on everything from having it all to having that sick feeling your government is trying to send you back to the Middle Ages. She the People stopped by the Centaur at the 2019 Just for Laughs. The troupe included former Montrealer Kirsten Rasmussen, as well as performers like Anne Parnell, Paloma Nunez, and Ashley Como. Carly Heffernan is an award-winning alumna of the Second City Toronto, where she wrote and performed in four main stage revues. We talked last summer about how to be funny and feminist. Carly Heffernan, director and writer of She the People.
Hello, Carly.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. So our performers include Anne Purnell. I've heard her on Because News. There's also Kirsten Rasmussen, who made her made a couple of years here in Montreal, performing and teaching at Montreal Improv, being in the Fringe Festival as well. It sounds like a very talented cast. Can you tell me, baby?
Oh, this cast is this cast is amazing. Yeah, Kirsten really cut her comedy teeth in Montreal, and it's such a great city to cut your teeth in. And then basically, it's a 6-person cast, all female identifying, and 5 of them are amazing Second City alumna, so they all wrote and performed on the Second City main stage in Toronto. And then we have sort of one up-and-comer, Trisha Black, but excitingly enough, she has just been announced that when she comes back from JSL in Montreal, she will be joining the new main stage cast for the 83rd Toronto Second City main stage review. So we're so proud of her.
Oh, wow. Does that mean she is leaving the show for the time being and joining another cast and you'll have to replace her? Or is that...
Exactly.
Okay, wow.
That's exactly it.
You're like...
She's going to be writing an original review on the Toronto main stage, which is super exciting. But we've actually already figured it out. When we pop over to Edmonton, another amazing Second City alumna, Ashley Bodding, is going to be joining the cast. And she is just such a veteran of this scene and such an amazing performer, amazing musical skills, amazing improv skills, amazing acting chops. So we're happy to bring her into the fold.
Ashley is one of those strange people that can make up like a song at the drop of a hat. Like if you just like took her to a store and pointed to a can of Spam and then said musical genre Hollywood, she would come up with something on the spot.
I was literally at a show on Monday. It's called Improv Karaoke here in Toronto, and Ashley Bodding got the suggestion of Slip and Slide, and I believe the genre was somewhere in the notion of Meatloaf, and it was one of the most beautiful ballads that I've ever heard in my life.
Oh my God, Meatloaf, I'm sold. So this is a series of sketches, She the People, and it's all about, I like this line, mimosa and madness fueled foray, but it's definitely got a feminist bent to it. So there's a lot of people who I think still say that if you're female, you're not funny. And then it's not really funny to do political stuff. I mean, obviously that's not the premise I'm going with here, but do you still find yourself rubbing up against people who say those things?
You know, I think that I personally have been around for so long, and now I'll date myself and age myself, that I don't get it too often, but I know they exist. I know these conversations are still had. They're more like sitting around the family table at Thanksgiving, and then, you know, you hear the, oh, you're still doing your lady skits. Yes, I am. I am, uncle. I am. everything being done in comedy right now, I love the way that comedy is sort of facing. And it's facing towards more authentic stories, more unique and diverse stories being told authentically. And that's what this show is. It's women who have traditionally not had as much space made for them in the comedy industry, just taking that space and telling our own stories. That said, I often describe the show as by women for everyone, because when I look out at our audiences from night to night, we have a great spectrum of human beings out there, and everyone's having an amazing time.
So tell me about that finding the female for funny, sorry, finding the funny for everybody, but written by women. Tell me about some of the content that we can see, or maybe your favorite sketch.
Oh, gosh, absolutely. We absolutely have things in this show that you wouldn't think to find in a traditional comedy show. Either we are touching on some darker subject matter. We're talking about reproductive rights. We're talking about the disbelief of assault victims. We're also talking about super relatable, recognizable things. Like the fact that we will all eventually turn into our parents one day. We cannot stop that. We're talking about our relationship with food and our relationship with our body. We're talking about love. We're talking about sex. We're talking about dating. But if I do have to choose a favorite, well, I have two, to be honest. We have an entirely movement-based piece that stars the most unlikable people from the news cycle right now, and that's how I'll describe it, and just watch out for it because it's such a stellar, amazing piece. It really brings the house down. And then my favorite piece has to be a scene that is entirely and solely about the absolute frustration and embarrassment you feel when you mispronounce a word in a public setting. And I love it.
Oh my gosh. I know that feeling well. Working in radio, it turns out this word you thought was misled. It was misled your whole life. Oh. And you were misled by the word and you said it wrong on air and everyone heard it. I know that feeling.
Oh, I love it. I used to call icing like icing on cake. For about 25 years, I thought it was icing. And I never knew why. And then I ended up on the phone with my mother and she's talking about my niece's birthday party. She said, oh, yeah, and there was a chocolate icing. And I thought, oh, there it is. This was a learned behavior. You led me astray for 25 years.
Oh, my gosh. The way mothers can, you know, really damage you is quite evident there. So icing, did that work its way into the show? Should we look for that?
Not the word icing, but it's a great word. And to be honest, it's such a perfect word for Montreal. It's definitely rooted en français.
Speaking with Carly Heffernan, who's the director and writer of She the People. So it is a big cast. So we've got 6 performers, and you were telling me about how everyone's really strong. Did everybody get a chance? I know not everyone was necessarily have a writing credit because you're there with Carissa, underwritten by, and the cast of Second City. Did the performers in this current iteration get to weigh in with some of the writing here?
When they absolutely got to weigh in and take characters that were already developed and written and sort of make them their own, right? We always allow from that. Second City is an improv theater. That's traditionally how we create and write our sketch material. So there's always room when you grab a cast together and you sort of lay out their character tracks for them, for each person to put their own unique spin on that character and adjust them and make everything natural to them and their voices and their bodies. We also let the show, like we do with most satire shows, we let it evolve to suit the news cycle. We allow the show to evolve and make sure that it can really speak to the absolute here and the absolute now. This cast is so amazing, though, and they're not only showing acting chops, there's amazing songs in the show, and we have such strong singers, such strong movers, and there is improv within the show, so you know as well as I do. Their scenes are going to change every night to night and literally are being written on the spot by the cast, being inspired by those Montreal audiences, taking their suggestions and inspiration and letting the scene be shaped by it. And there's even a couple opportunities for some audience members to come up on stage and play with the cast.
Oh, great. So definitely sit in the first or second row. In that case.
Oh, you got it. Yeah. You absolutely have to. And get ready to just shoot your hand right up. Really volunteer yourself.
Well, and that's a quick question for you, Carly. You mentioned that a lot of the stuff is topical. There's one sketch in particular that has a couple people in the news to be featured. So how do you write the sketches, but also keep it fresh? Like, there's so many things happening every single week that you could easily like do a 30 to 1 hour show on, but you know, like, does it feel dated if you're talking about the last anti-woman scandal from, you know, a month or two ago, whereas there's something else in the news today? How do you deal with that?
Right. Whenever we're looking at satire, we're looking at what the root of that satire is, and our working definition is always looking at the world around you, identifying something that you disagree with and putting it on stage in an absurd way so you can have that cathartic comedic effect. So whenever we're looking at the roots of these frustrations, they're frustrations that have been with us for decades, sometimes centuries, some of this stuff. And you'd be surprised that once you find the root of it, it's easy to continue to find the freshness within the news cycle. Those microaggressions that we've been facing for centuries, we're always going to be facing them. So they're still going to feel fresh. But when you add in a line speaking to maybe how the president of the United States feels about the co-captain of the American women's soccer team, it feels really topical and of the now. But the real frustration there is something that we've been feeling for years and years and years. So it feels evergreen while also feeling super topical and fresh.
Carly Heffernan is the very talented and funny director and one of the writers of She the People. Thank you so much, Carly.
Oh, thank you so much. I can't wait for you all to see the show.
That was Carly Heffernan, director and writer of She the People. Follow Carly on Twitter at Carly Heffernan and on Instagram with an added period at carly.heffernan. Visit secondcity.com. I'm Sarah Day. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. I'm revisiting past interviews with some of the talent that pops into town for Just for Laughs. Seeing as how this is the month where the comedy festival would usually be on, it has been postponed. There are events coming up this coming fall. You can find out more information at hahaha.com. But in the meantime, going down memory lane, revisiting some past interviews. And the final one this evening is Ari Shaffir. Born in New York City, raised in North Carolina and Maryland, Ari's made his mark doing stand-up, he's acted in commercials, and he's also a big podcaster. He started his show Skeptic Tank in 2011. His guests are mostly comedians ready to discuss topics they are experts in. Ari is a frequent visitor to Just for Laughs. He also recently stirred up controversy a few months ago when basketball star Kobe Bryant passed away in a helicopter crash with his daughter and several of their friends. Ari had tweeted a video where he referenced Bryant's past accusations of sexual assault, adding that he hated his team, the Lakers. After receiving threats, one comedy club canceled Ari's show there. And then he later explained that he regularly tears down celebrities who have died. Ari said, quote, "I've been doing it for years now. I like destroying gods. And right when a famous person dies, they're at their most worshipped. So as a response to all the outpouring of sympathy on social media, I post something vile. It's just a joke. I don't really hate any of the people. That's just dark comedy. It ain't for everybody, so I don't post it for everybody. I post it for my followers who are into that kind of comedy." Interesting point about when it's okay to make fun of people, when it's not. He kind of said, "I didn't know that children had passed away in the helicopter crash." He had posted the video 6 hours after the news broke. So kind of this question of comedians putting their jokes online, and it's available for anyone to see. But if you don't get their sense of humor, is the joke really for you? I think with Kobe Bryant's death, I think a lot of people would argue that it would be completely inappropriate to make any kind of joke whatsoever, considering, who passed away and the gravity of what happened. But it's just an interesting case note in, like, when is appropriate to make jokes about what. So that is the latest with Ari Shaffir. But here is my conversation with him in 2018. On a terrace at the hotel that serves as the headquarters at Just for Laughs every single summer.
So I understand that your entree into comedy involved working the doors at, I think, the Comedy Cellar, is that right?
Comedy Store in New York. In L.A. The way they have a kind of unique, where they hire wannabe comedians specifically for that reason, to do non-comedy jobs so you can sit there and watch comedy and grow and learn. So yeah, I start on the phones daytime, and then I moved to the door, and then I sat people, cover booth. I just did everything there I could until eventually I was like not awful enough where I could like perform in the lineup.
And how does that happen? You just end up asking people as much as possible, like, you know, I've got an opening, can I be on tonight?
No. It was one lady who just died, Mitzi Shore. She was, like, in charge of all of it. And she just, every Sunday back then, now it's Monday, but every Sunday she would come in and just, sometimes she was just there to see, like, new comics, but sometimes she'd come in early and just, like, I want to see all the employees. And if you were good enough, she was like, all right, you're in. You're a regular now. Like, you know, more employee spots for you. Now you're, like... It was 3 minutes every Sunday. It was so little. But then, like, now it's like you can go on the regular lineup. But then on the other hand, if she was like, you're not progressing at all, she was just like, you're fired. Yeah, get out. I don't want you here. You have no talent.
There was no, like, review where she could, like, give you pointers or, like,
no, there was that.
Someone else?
There was that a little bit for me, I think, more than most people. I don't know why. I didn't really know the system when I got there. So I just, like, asked somebody. I'm like, hey, can that lady give me some advice? And then, so she started doing that. But then she started f***ing with me, too. Oh, I'm sorry, is this radio?
All good.
Okay. I'll try to limit it. Is that Virgil from WWE?
With this festival going on, anybody could
be
anybody.
Yeah, normally I was like, who is that guy? And then I was like...
Are you a wrestling fan?
No, but I remember Virgil from way, way back. Yeah.
And so tell me, I wanted to ask about, you know, the fact that you do comedy, stand-up, you got Netflix specials, all that stuff. But on top of that, you end up podcasting, you're doing storytelling shows on top. Where does that interest come from for you?
What interest? What do you mean?
Like to also do like a, you have two storytelling shows, three. You had one last night, I think.
Yes, last night.
It went well?
And Saturday. Yeah, it was great. Miss Pat was so, so crazy. She's crazy, man. She told a story about her. I can't get her mentally. How do I say this better than her? Her mentally disabled uncle helping as a child. She had to help him have sex.
No, really?
Yeah, she grew up way different than me. But yeah, it's fun. So that started with me just like talking to my comedian friends and then realizing that we all had these stories and comedians just sort of tell stories. I was going to say, I don't want to say better, but no, I do want to say it better. We tell them better than normcore people. So we just like put on a show at the Improv, a small show with like Joey Diaz and Mark Maron and a couple other people. And it went great. And we're just like, let's just keep doing this. And comedians have stories. One, they get into crazy stuff. But two, they're able to turn regular things into fun, you know, ways to entertain. Because comedy really, at its heart, I think is like, I don't really know the history of it too well. I just know the now. But it's sort of storytelling. It's sort of a way to like, you know, convey things that have happened. So this is just really one part of the game. It's not like separate to me. Like guys like Anthony Jeselnik, who are like really good at one-liners, that's just another part of the game. And then stories is like part of the game. And just like bits are part of it. It's just all part of it. So we've just sort of like isolated it a little bit. And it's just fun. So we just kept doing them and doing them and doing them.
So how do you... Have you developed ways to get people to tell you even better stories? As you're saying, like, comedians, A, come with a better bank of stories than most people. Number two, they're used to just talking in front of people. But you, like, hosting and bringing people on stage, like, you have to find a way to kind of tease things out, right?
Yeah, yeah. You have to learn how to, like, milk stuff or, like, say things in the right way. I mean, I told one story, I think, on my old show that was, like, I think it happened over, like, 30 seconds. But then I managed to tell it over, like, 7 or 8 minutes. Just because, like, you deal with details, you put metaphor in. The hard part is finding comics. You ask, like, hey, do you have any good stories? And they go, most of them go, like, not really. And then you got to remind them, like, well, what about the time you went to Portugal and you took the train, you went to the wrong place? Like, and they're like, oh, yeah, yeah. So one method we use is, me and my friend Eric Abrams, is we choose a topic. And then we'll be like, I don't have any stories. And I'm like, okay, well, we're doing road stories. I'm like, oh, no, I do have one about the road. Like, if you limit it somehow, it makes them, like, think of it more. Or, like, we'll say, like, breakup stories. I'm like, oh, actually, yeah, I got a good breakup story. I'm like, okay, cool, do that. And so sometimes when we limit it like that, we ask people, like, I asked my friend Rick Ingram. I was like, do you have any, like, psychedelic stories? And he goes, no. I'm like, you haven't done them? He goes, no, I've done them a few times. I just, nothing crazy has happened. And that answer, I'm always like, cool, I'll ask you over the next time. And then I think I did. I think I had him on a breakup episode. And he was like, oh, I do have stuff about that. So, yeah, it's just a question of, like, reminding them somehow. Or it's stuff that have been in parties that I've heard.
Yeah.
Like, Jeff Dye had the story about stealing some Adam Vinatieri's jersey that was hung up in his bar in the Florida Keys. And I was like, hey, man, can you come on my show and do that story? You know, they're, like, party stories that, like, are easily convertible. So, yeah, when I actually know a real story, then I'm like, do that one.
Tell me, like, is there anyone you've ever worked, like, time and time again to try to get them on, like, a big name or someone you look up to and you finally got them?
Yeah. Well, early on, I can't get them anymore, but early on I got Bill Burr and Jim Jeffries, who are both really good at that form.
Bill's one of your press clips, I think, or, like, one of your promo lines.
Uh-huh. Yeah. He gave me a go watch Ari line. Yeah. It's too... I fucking hate these reviews. Sorry. These reviewers I use in the UK, and they're all, like... I just think they're such garbage. So then it's like, instead of using, that's where they have just clips of like, go see him, wonderful show. I'm like, nah, let me just use actual comedians that the people who are going watching to respect. So I got like Attell and Jimmy Carr and Burr. And yeah, I was like, just say one nice thing about me. And they're like, yeah, it's no problem. And then they do. Russell Peters was the best. He was like, can you just, oh no, it wasn't for that. It was for my Netflix special. He goes, can you just tell me exactly what to tweet? And I'll just tweet that. Just send it to me and I'll just...
I had a boss who wouldn't write recommendations letters. He'd say, you
really?
Write your own letter, like your full one-page recommendation for like law school, and then I'll sign it.
Yeah, because I get it. He's like, no, I'll say you're great, but don't make me do the work, you know? So it's like, just tell me what to say. I support you, so fine.
So who is one person who you like to have on at some point that you're working at or, you know, your shoot for the moon person?
I tried getting Jeselnik, actually, now that we mentioned him. And at some point I kept asking him, he's like, no, I'm busy. And I'm like, hey... Do you want me to stop asking you? And he goes, yeah, I think I made that pretty clear. He's like, I just don't do stories. I'm like, all right. I like getting people who don't normally do that stuff to then do it. So, like, getting Russell Peters here in Montreal once was, like, he got real dirty, and he doesn't normally do that on stage. So, it's, like, to me, that's, like, a joy to see people, like, leave their normal stuff. So, Gabriel Iglesias, I've been close on getting him a few times. But it's just fun to see people, like, be able to depart from, like, their normal stand-up to, like, just try something. And they get nervous, too, which is fun.
I think as a comedy audience, you get used to seeing one side of your favorite comedian, right? Uh-huh. You see them the way they perform, and then when you see them out of character, quote-unquote, yeah, you see something completely different. That's what you're trying to get.
Yeah, and these stories are really, like, who you are, and you can't put up a wall, which is fine to do, but, like, it's just also interesting to see when that drops. You know, to be like, well, you're a great joke writer, but, like, I want to know something about you. And so a lot of times with bits, you don't really get to know them as much as their views on something. And this is just a fun, he really is like talked to them at a party. So it's just a fun, really way to like get to know them.
Has, you know, having people on stage and going after comedians and trying to suss out the good stories, convince people to come on, and then having to hear them once or twice, right? Has that informed your own way of doing things as a comic?
What do you mean?
Like, the experience of doing the storytelling shows, like, has that informed the way you've done your own delivery or not at all?
Yeah. The cool thing about doing these shows, we did them about once a month in LA when I was living there before I moved to New York, and then, like, festivals here or there. So I got to see just tons of comedians. Jim Gaffigan, I want to get on. He's another one where I've, like, been close but not quite. Oh, Dave Attell is the number one. I keep asking him. I build stories around him. Like, how about road stories? And he's like, oh, maybe. I'm like, how about alcohol stories? I know you have these. And he's like, oh. He doesn't like opening up. But yeah, when you see people do it over and over again, you start seeing technique. That's why Mitzi put us on the door, so we could watch like better comics and not see the material as much as we're seeing how they're doing their material, how they're like pretending to forget and then like remembering. Like at first you don't even notice it, and then you start seeing the actual like technical side of it. So yeah, I remember seeing a Marin story about I think going to a Grateful Dead concert, and the ending was so good. I had it recorded. I just watched it over and over and over again. And it was like, it's because endings are difficult for stories to like wrap up so the crowd feels like good about it's over, like a tension release. And he did it so well that I was like, yeah, you can just learn from that, you know? And then you learn how to like set things in earlier so you can pay them off at the end to like set them off. But absolutely, I learned technique from people. Sean Patton, he's so good at stories where it's like I watch him and it reminds me of like, oh yeah, I gotta do that or I gotta do that. So, yeah, absolutely. It makes me way better. It's almost, like, unfair.
Is it funner now to watch other comics working because you can see... I mean, I guess everyone gets to the point where you can see the screws, the wheels turning, but, like, it doesn't take away from your ability to enjoy it.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can see the technique. I see some mistakes, like, kids make, and then I get sort of embarrassed. I'm like, that is Virgil, by the way, because I see he's sitting with not Nikolai Volkov's nephew. What's his name? The Iron Sheik's nephew. So they're in the wrestling world for sure. Okay, I was right. And I haven't watched wrestling for 20 plus years.
I think you're a wrestling fan.
I'm
like
not.
It's secretly.
It was the WWF times before they switched to WWE. I mean, 25 years I haven't watched. But I think that's him. What was the question?
Maybe you tell a story on your show.
Yeah. Oh, we had a few. Roddy Piper told one. Yeah. We had some few non-comics tell one too. We've had some non-comics and. Yeah, he might. But the problem is with non-comics, sometimes they just have no idea how to deliver stuff. So I watch these young comics sometimes. And I see them make mistakes, and I'm like, oh, I used to do that. Where, like, this one guy, I'm not going to say who, I don't like telling comics negatives. But he kept, like, laughing at his punchlines. And I realized what he was doing, and I had done it too in the past, was, like, you didn't get a laugh from the crowd. So you're like, and then I told a punchline, you do like that. And it's almost like it covers up the fact they're not laughing. And that's okay to do like once or maybe twice in 15 minutes. But when you start doing it over and over again, it becomes like obvious and like awful. So I can see that and be like, oh, I got to remember, never do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, the same thing when I took jiu-jitsu and like they would like keep pairing you up for drills with different people. And then I would go against like brown belts when I was starting. And I'm like, I'm sorry for slowing down. But they were all almost universally. They were like, oh, no, it helps me remember the specifics of what I'm supposed to do to have to teach you.
Yeah,
so it's kind of cool to watch horror comics. And then also you see some, like, new styles that you're like, whoa, I've never tried something like that before. Interesting. Yeah, it's great to watch comics. Some comics don't want to watch other comedians because they're afraid they're going to, like, their stuff is going to seep into their heads and they're going to steal it by accident.
Yeah.
But I'm like, guys, just know yourself enough to know when you're not doing something that's yours.
But also...
The joy of watching stand-up just because you're afraid of, like, a joke might get stolen. Just don't steal jokes.
But also a lot of the content you're covering is universal, right? Like everyone's going to share a breakup story or a complaint about dating on stage. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah, and then you get to see... So my style, this, you heard of The Moth? So it's another style of storytelling show, but they're real dark. They're real,
I
like,
almost
woe is me.
Very much don't even listen to The Moth anymore because I've always felt so down taking
down.
It.
And then you occasionally get a comment like Mike DiStefano. Yeah, and he tells like a great story on there or two actually, but it's like it's from a comedian, so it's hilarious the whole way. So like, I get if your father died, but like, why do you have to be sad about it? You can make jokes about it and still show your sadness without having to like make the crowd sad too. Make them like skirt over like a dark moment.
But you might forget that people find comedy hard. Like someone who's not a trained comedian.
Yeah, but trained comedians should not do that. So all these UK comics who are, I can't curse like, but all they do is get dark and like serious for 20 minutes. I'm like, I get you wanting to deal with serious topics, but why are you doing it a serious way? You're a comic. I started a campaign to get, if people see my fans, if you see on Twitter a comedian just making like political statements without any attempt at humor, you should call them out on it. And I was like, and me too. I said, I'm not calling after anyone specific. I'm saying if you see somebody making like, Donald Trump sucks, I'm like, there's no joke there. So I'm like, call them out. Say like, wow, is this going to be part of your new Netflix special? It's so funny. Like, make fun of them. And then Greg Fitzsimmons got mad because like people kept like going after him. And he was like, what is this all coming from? And somebody said, ask Ari. And he was like, what are you saying? I'm like, I'm saying you should be funny. He goes, you're saying we shouldn't like do stuff about politics? I'm like, no, I'm not saying that. I'm saying you're one of the best comedy writers in the world. If you can't make this topic funny, then we're all lost. Like, that's your art form. Do that. Make your points in comedy. And all these comics are just so serious now. Ugh.
But it's the political climate.
Fuck that. It doesn't matter. So be political in your stuff. If you're a musician, you don't like stop the music and then make your statement. You make a song about the politics. So make jokes about it. That's how you get people to get won over. Oh, it's so annoying to me. I'm like, what's suddenly because you care, you're not going to be a comic anymore? It's bullshit.
Can I ask one last question? What's the thing that pisses you off the most politically right now? Like, if you had to be funny about something serious, what would it be?
I'm a troll. I'm a longtime troll. I have roots from way back in, web board times where you can really go after like one person trying to make them mad. So the way people go after Trump so hard, where they go overboard, where it's like, God, you're losing the argument by adding stuff that's not even part of it, you know, where they'll say something like, I'm trying to think of something right now. I mean, he's garbage, but then like okay, here's a good example. After he got elected, before he took office, remember the Keystone Pipeline? So they were hosing people, you know, down, and they were like, this is Trump's America. And it was like, he hasn't taken office yet. This is Obama's America. This was like December. So like, you can't put things on him. I get hating him, but just for the things he does. So like, the stuff that he's not responsible for, it just bothers me. It's like, just make an actual joke about it and go after him. It's fine. But like, be real about it. I don't know.
Ari, thanks for taking the time. Have fun tonight. You've got a storytelling show and a stand at one.
Yeah, I'm doing all about Jews now. I'm trying to cover my past.
Apparently, you didn't want to talk about like Judaism and your whole journey, but now you're ready. Is that?
I wasn't good enough. That's the thing. I wasn't good enough. So it's like these comics who get serious on Twitter. It's like, I get it if you're not good enough, but if you are good enough, and you're all good enough for Twitter to make a 140 character, 280 character joke, you're all good enough for that. So I wasn't good enough to cover these topics from my past, and now I am.
To do a whole hour.
Yeah, to do a whole hour. So I've been working on it for a year, and I'm taking this to Edinburgh for all those stupid Edinburgh comics who don't feel like they can be funny and be thematic. I'm showing them that America is the country that invented stand-up comedy and perfected it. So learn from me.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
That was comedian Ari Shaffir, a frequent Just for Laughs guest back when he was here in 2017. Visit him at arithegreat.com, Ari Shaffir on Instagram and Twitter, and his podcast, where he invites comics on to be experts in something. It's called Skeptic Tank. You've been listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM, the show about theater on the radio. Thank you for tuning in to this episode, looking back on some of my favorite Just for Laughs interviews, including British comic David Baddiel, Canadian comedy writer and director Carly Heffernan of She the People, and of course, American comic Ari Shaffir. You can hear past episodes of Upstage at ckut.ca under the archives. I'm your host, Sarah De A. Thank you so much to Tamara at CKUT for making sure this show gets to air, and thank you for tuning in. Speak with you next time on Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and CKUT.ca. Until next time, stay home, stay safe.
Did you get vaccinated?
Not yet, but I will soon.
And which one are you getting?
I'm getting the dance vaccine.
The dance vaccine? Great idea.
Yeah, rehearsing with the girls is what I miss the most.
Well, it's gonna be the soccer vaccine for me. I can't wait to see the gang again.
Each vaccination brings us closer to these moments. Follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book an appointment at quebec.ca/COVID vaccine.
A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Are you a tenant in Montreal? Do you have questions about your rights? Your local housing committee can help. To find the housing committee for your neighborhood or for more resources, go to www.rclalq.qc.ca.
We'll be right back. CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is ongoing throughout Quebec. The combined effect of two doses ensures better efficacy of the vaccine, reducing the risk of getting and transmitting the virus. You'll also stay protected for a longer period of time. Coming to your appointment for the second dose of the vaccine is a must, whatever else is on your schedule. The second dose of vaccine is essential. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
To the power hitter of FM radio. Keep it tuned to CKUT 90.3 FM.
I think the magnitude of this will probably not sink in or talked about or understood for a while.
CKUT.
Good evening and welcome to the June 24th edition.